Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
I wanted to see, are we able to get scientific reports from the scientific service of the German Bundestag via freedom of information after the court ruling? And the answer is not yet.
A German website is pushing the limits of freedom of information requests. Hello and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Cyrus Farivar in Bonn, Germany, with what's new in the world of European science and technology news. Meanwhile, in Austria, scientists are exploring the frontier of quantum computing.
A classical bit would be the north and the south pole of a sphere, and a quantum bit can take all points on the sphere as a state. So it's many, many states. That's what makes the quantum computer much more powerful than a classical computer.
Plus, a French scientist thinks that not even professional violinists can tell the difference between the famed Stradivarius violin and a newer one. But first, the international fight for intellectual property online is far from over. All that and more this week on Spectrum. Before we get started, you may have noticed Spectrum's new theme music. This is part of the new Deutsche Welle relaunch, which just went live on Sunday. If you haven't checked out the new DW site, I really encourage you to do so. You can find it at dw.de. We've made things a lot easier to navigate, and hopefully you'll now have better access to our audio and video content as well. We'd love to hear what you think. All right. Okay, and now on to the show. So, you've heard of SOPA, an American anti-piracy bill that was met with resounding opposition by websites from around the world. Within the last few weeks, there have also been similar protests in Poland, Slovenia, and Bulgaria against ACTA, a new major international treaty that also aims to stop online piracy. But a similar digital rights saga in Italy has largely gone unnoticed. Last week, Italian free speech and libertarian groups spearheaded a revolt against the so-called Italian SOPA, a reference to the controversial U.S. anti-piracy bill. The groups claimed the legislation would have dealt a major blow to free speech in Italy and beyond. But since Italian politicians across the political spectrum voted against the amendment, the free speech groups are claiming victory, for now. In Milan, Sean Sharigian reports.
This is Luca Nicotra, secretary of Italian free speech group Digital Agora. At this press conference last Tuesday, he was pretty worked up. That's because just a few days earlier, a tiny amendment that came to be known as the Italian SOPA entered Italy's legislative agenda. Supporters claimed the amendment would fight piracy, but Nicotra says the only effect would have been a savage removal of content from the internet. If the charge echoes criticism of U.S. anti-piracy bills SOPA and PIPA, Digital Agora says that's not a coincidence. Like those bills, the Italian legislation, known as Amendment 18, would have made servers on the internet responsible for all the content they hosted. It also would have broadened the range of groups that could notify servers of copyright infringements, from legal authorities to practically anyone. Being notified of an infringement would make a server legally responsible for it. Guglielmo Troiano, a lawyer for Digital Agora, says the amendment violated free speech.
It's absolutely a free speech issue, because the law would inhibit people from uploading content for fear of being persecuted. The same goes for the service provider. Because it would need to preventively monitor all content uploaded, it would be afraid to upload a lot of content. A lot of expression would be cut from the start.
Amendment 18 came from parliamentarian Giovanni Fava, who is also head of a parliamentary inquest into contraband and piracy. He says the amendment deals with e-commerce, not free speech, and that critics are taking it out of context. Not least of those critics is the hacker group Anonymous, who Fava says shut down his personal website for several hours late last month.
I never wanted to block ideas and opinions. That was never my intention. All I did was carry out my task as president of the commission, which was to protect property and to protect legality.
Nevertheless, parliamentarians across the political spectrum slammed the amendment in voting last Thursday. It seems Digital Agora's press conference mobilized every party in the lower house of deputies, except Fava's own right-leaning Northern League. Italy's major parties voted on five amendments of their own to suppress Fava's legislation. As of now, it looks like Fava's bill won't go anywhere. Jeremy Zimmerman, founder of the French internet advocacy group La Quadrature du Net, says the recent Italian experience has lessons for both ordinary internet users and activists.
So it's one other illustration that we can make it and that we can win when we reappropriate the public space and the public debate. Then we win.
Both sides of the Italian piracy debate are working on their next steps. Troiano of Digital Agora says his group is seeking to end a monopoly held by the Italian Society of Authors and Editors on how people pay for copyrights. Meanwhile, Fava says Italian telecom regulator Agicom is working on e-commerce regulations that won't touch on issues of free speech. Fava also says he can see a bright side to the failure of his amendment.
I'm not particularly disappointed the amendment was rejected. I'm happy that this subject, which affects millions of people, families and businesses, has finally entered our country's political agenda.
However, Italy was one of 22 European countries that recently signed ACTA, a controversial intellectual property protection treaty already agreed upon by many large countries around the world. This past week, a few countries are backtracking on their decision to sign it, most notably Poland. That's because after tens of thousands of people turned out to protest, Polish President Donald Tusk said he would halt the ratification process. Other European countries are reconsidering their position. Shat Sharigyan, Deutsche Welle Radio, Milan, Italy.
A curious battle has been raging in Berlin's administrative court over the past few months involving the Bundestag, the Freedom of Information Act, and UFOs. Yep, you heard right. In December 2011, the Berlin Administrative Court made a landmark decision against the Bundestag, ruling that the reports of the Parliamentary Scientific Service were accessible to the public under the Freedom of Information laws. And that means new requests for a young site, Frag den Staat, or Ask the State, have jumped within the last month. Daniel Bischten reports from Berlin.
Here at St. Oberholt's co-working space in Berlin's Prenzlauer Berg district, Stefan Wehrmeier is describing the praise from Germany's Federal Freedom of Information Commissioner for his project, Frag den Staat. Wehrmeier is a 24-year-old computer engineering student who in August last year launched an open-source, volunteer-driven project that could potentially reset Germany's notoriously hardwired approach to freedom of information. Although inspired by a similar project in the UK, Frag den Staat was coded from scratch by Stefan and volunteers from the Open Knowledge Foundation to account for Germany's more complex state structure and legislation. Frag den Staat aims to be a one-stop portal for freedom of information in Germany, walking users through the process of refining a request and picking the relevant department. The legal aspects are all taken care of. Users don't require any knowledge of the law to use the service, and Frag den Staat merely acts as a carefully targeted conduit to facilitate requests and publish the results.
If you make a request, it is basically default is that it's public, and anyone else who has a similar request can already see, okay, there's this request, and he can already take the information from the request, and then he doesn't have to request the same thing, but you can request something more specific or help the person that requested in the first place by adding a comment and say, okay, you should also request this. This is more interesting.
Germany's Bundestag, or federal parliament, has a branch known as the Wissenschaftlicher Dienst, or Scientific Service. This is a taxpayer-funded research body that produces reports for the Bundestag, which are available to members of parliament and can inform policy decisions. Many of these reports are published by the Bundestag, but not all of them, leading to suspicions of political manipulation.
They are sometimes mentioned in the press releases from a member of parliament. They may mention these reports in their speeches, but if they're not publicly listed, it's really difficult to get an idea of what the scientific service is producing. And this is a bad thing, I guess, because we need to know what the MPs are basing their decisions on, and this really should be publicly available. I mean, scientific service should be peer-reviewed.
Last year, one man took the Bundestag to court over access to these documents in a landmark case that was ultimately ruled in his favour, that these scientific reports should be accessible to the public under freedom of information laws. When Wehrmeier heard about this decision, he lodged a request for this same report, which was recently denied by the Bundestag. He was told that they were going to appeal the decision in the Supreme Administrative Court, a move that raises questions about their motives. The topic of this particular report? the search for extraterrestrial life and unidentified flying objects.
So I requested the same report about the UFOs because the original one wasn't publicly available. I wanted to see, are we able to get scientific reports from the scientific service of the German Bundestag via freedom of information after the court ruling? And the answer is not yet.
He says it will probably take another year or two to get a reply.
So this UFO request is now kind of the example case, and that's why everybody's looking at it. It's not about UFOs, I guess, it's just about freedom of information in the German Bundestag.
But the Bundestag's decision to appeal is not surprising if you look at their track record. That's according to Dominik Berker, a Köln-based lawyer specialising in telecommunications and intellectual property law. He says that the government's attitude to freedom of information has improved but still has some way to go. But still, he's pleased that there are now online tools that make this access easier.
Frag den Staat was the first platform collecting freedom of information requests and publishing the answers. And it's a platform that is brilliant, and they should be supported by even the federal state and the administration.
Berker says that even if the appeal of the current ruling is successful, there are still grounds for an appeal of that decision, so the battle is far from over. Meanwhile, Wehrmeier is eagerly awaiting the outcome and planning further campaigns for Frag dein Staat. Daniel Bischten, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Coming up, a French scientist looks at the psychological equivalent of the placebo effect. But first, here's Holly Fox with the news.
The anti-internet piracy treaty, known as ACTA, continues to face stiff opposition in some European countries. Opponents say that the treaty gives too much power to the judicial system and government to go after sites accused of piracy. After the government of Bulgaria signed the treaty, some members of parliament wore masks associated with the internet activist group Anonymous in session, following a similar move in Poland. The Slovenian representative to the ACTA negotiations has also apologized for her signature and support of the treaty. Meanwhile, the Polish president has halted the ratification process after protests in his country. February 11th has been set as a day for larger-scale ACTA protests across Europe. In a related story, Sweden's Supreme Court ruled last Wednesday not to hear the appeal of four founders of controversial The Pirate Bay website, the world's largest clearinghouse of peer-to-peer BitTorrent file sharing. The decision may not come as a surprise, but could have huge implications for the internet. Carl Lundstrom, Fredrik Nye, and Peter Zunda were denied appeal. Together with another founder who was ill and did not attend the appeal, the four men now face prison sentences of between 4 and 10 months and a combined fine of $6.8 million. All four have since moved abroad, and it is unclear when and how they will need to pay up and serve their jail sentences. European privacy regulators have called on Google to stop its new privacy policy. This past week, the Article 29 Working Party says it needs more time to investigate if Google's new changes violate European data protection law before the new policy comes into effect on March 1st. Google's new policy will combine existing policies and use of data across all of its websites, including YouTube, Gmail, and Blogspot, into a single policy. The request from the Article 29 group comes on the heels of a new proposal to overhaul the existing European Union data protection rules. According to a report last week in the journal Nature, Norway is set to become the first country to incorporate genome sequencing into its national healthcare system. The Nordic country plans to use so-called next-generation DNA sequencers to look for mutations that might help doctors figure out which cancer treatments would help the most. As part of a 3-year pilot, the Norwegian Cancer Genomics Consortium also said last week that it will sequence the tumor genomes of 1,000 patients to hopefully improve their treatments. And finally today, watch out what you post publicly on social media sites. According to the German news agency DPA, the Berlin State Police says it wants to be active on Twitter and Facebook. While other German states currently do use social media, the Hanover City Police stopped their online activities in late January over privacy concerns. Law enforcement in other cities have said that internet searches are useful in prevention of crime and public relations.
Holly Fox with the news there. You're listening to Spectrum on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Sarus Farivar. Now, if you're like me and you're never near your actual radio when Spectrum comes on, feel free to download it as a podcast. Take us with you on your commute or listen at your computer whenever you like. Every day when I bike to work, I always have my favorite podcast in my earbuds. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's going on. Beyond that, come and interact with us online. See what I'm reading and get a taste of what we're working on between shows on Twitter at DW_SciTech. Send me a message and I will write you back. Promise. And now it's time for Digital Europe.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Imagine for a moment that the promise of powerful, super-fast quantum computers has materialized. Just like in the days of regular computers at first, there will only be a few of them, housed in very special facilities. Users who want to harness their quantum capabilities will need to send data to a remote location, allowing the computer to do its magic and send back the results. Quantum physicists have shown that there's a way to do this that's absolutely secure, meaning the remote quantum computer will never understand the true data, even while it's manipulating it. This is called blind quantum computing. Though other researchers have described the theory behind such a blind quantum computing protocol a few years ago, a group of scientists in Vienna have become the first to demonstrate that it works. The results were published last month in the journal Science. Shruti Pinnamaneni reports from Vienna.
Have you ever wondered what a quantum computer actually looks like?
Here is our laser. Then we have crystals, we have optical elements like wave blades, we have beam splitters, optical fibers.
Stephanie Batz, a PhD student at the Vienna Center for Quantum Science and Technology, is showing me a type of quantum computer that uses light particles, or photons, to hold and manipulate data. It looks nothing like an ordinary computer, more like a pinball machine, dissected into a maze of crystal cubes and optical lenses. Using this setup, Batz led a group of scientists to demonstrate what is called blind quantum computing. But to get what all this means, we need to first understand the plain vanilla version of quantum computing.
Quantum mechanics is based on numbers called amplitudes, which can be positive or negative.
That's Scott Aronson, Associate Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the United States. Aronson explains that the different ways in which an event could happen is each assigned a particular amplitude. Take the event of snow tomorrow. The actual probability that it snows tomorrow is simply a function of all the amplitudes for all the possible conditions under which it could snow tomorrow.
That's a very weird picture of the world, right? Like, we're not born, you know, knowing that the world is described by this list of amplitudes. Okay, but then once you swallow that, everything else that people talk about with quantum mechanics, all of it can just be explained in a few sentences.
Take, for instance, a quantum bit, or qubit, the basic unit of information in a quantum computer. A qubit is a list of two amplitudes, either 0 or 1, which correspond to the chance that it's in an off state or an on state. But a qubit can also be in any intermediate state between 0 and 1. Batz explains why that is the key difference between an ordinary computer bit and a quantum bit.
A classical bit would be the north and the south pole of a sphere, and a quantum bit can take all points on the sphere as a state. So it's many, many states. That's what makes the quantum computer much more powerful than a classical computer.
A popular misconception, however, is that quantum computers will be more powerful than ordinary computers in every respect. Again, here's Aronson.
It's not a panacea that lets us solve every type of problem faster, but for certain specific problems, like, you know, these code-breaking applications or like quantum simulation, you know, it really does offer the promise of a very dramatic type of speed-up.
Sending emails or playing Angry Birds, we are probably better off on our normal computers, he says. In any case, given the technology available right now, scientists have only been able to build very basic quantum computers that are neither stable nor powerful. This is where Batz and her group come in, to imagine the future of quantum computing.
all these challenges in realizing quantum computers might lead to the conclusion that in the future, only a few computing centers will be able to operate those devices.
Meaning that scientists will have to send their valuable data to a quantum computer on a remote server. Blind quantum computing is simply the absolutely secure way for users to do this. The blind qubits are created using the configuration of crystals and optics that we saw earlier. The remote quantum computer receives these qubits and a set of calculation instructions, both of which are encrypted such that the computer can perform the calculation without actually knowing what kind of calculation it is performing.
And then the server gets results like zeros and ones, but for the server, these results appear totally random. And the client can interpret the results and knows the output of the computation.
This particular demonstration of blind quantum computing uses a total of 4 qubits. Bartz's group is considering working on a version that uses more qubits and is capable of more complex calculations. But to take a step back, a stable, powerful quantum computer doesn't yet exist, nor do we have any idea when it actually will. Still, Aronson says he is fairly impressed with the results coming out of Austria.
The results of these sorts of experiments are never surprising once you know the theory. And yet actually doing the experiment takes, you know, a lot of craftsmanship. It's very hard to get quantum mechanical experiments to work right.
In other words, the point of such quantum computing research is to improve and test our understanding of quantum mechanics, which in many ways is the biggest challenge of all, perhaps bigger than building a quantum computer. Shruti Panamaneni, Deutsche Welle Radio, Vienna.
If you like, you can download Digital Europe as a separate podcast. Just search for DW Digital Europe in iTunes. And finally today, let's talk about violins. It's commonly held wisdom that the best violins are those that were built by Antonio Stradivari, the famed 17th and 18th century Italian violin maker. They frequently fetch millions of dollars at auction. But in a scientific paper published just last month, Claudia Fritz of the University of Paris found that 21 concert violinists at an international competition in the United States thought that modern instruments were rather more pleasing than the famous Stradivarius. In your new paper, from what I understand, you have demonstrated that even trained professional violinists, counter to what I think most people would expect, apparently can't seem to tell the difference between modern produced violins and the kind of gold standard of historic, well-made, crafted violins, which are the Stradivarius violins. Am I understanding that right?
Yes, this is correct.
Okay.
So out of 21 players, 17 answered the question about, you know, can you guess the make or age of the violin you chose as a preferred one? And out of the 17, 7 guessed wrong. 7 couldn't answer, so they just said, no, there is no way I can tell. And 3 actually guessed correctly only. So although many players claim that they can definitely say whether a violin is old or not, they actually can't when they can't see the violin.
Can you lay out the experiment for me? What did you have the subjects do?
So we had 6 violins, so 3 old and 2 Stradivari and 1 Guarneri and 3 modern ones. In the first part of the study, the violins were presented by pair with always 1 old, 1 new. Obviously, this was not known by the players. He didn't know anything about how many violins actually there were at this stage. So they were presented by pairs, and the participants had to play them for 1 minute each, and at the end of the 2 minutes, say which one you would prefer.
So they said which one they preferred, not which one was the Stradivarius.
No. At that stage, there were nothing about age or anything. It was which one they preferred.
Okay.
Only because we didn't want to put any bias. We didn't want them to feel they could be wrong or anything. It was really, you know, they are the experts. They know what they like. And we ask their judgment as an expert. And so it was really important to phrase it in a way where they could all answer safely in a way, you know. So preference is a matter of choice, so you can't be wrong with that.
And these violinists, are they professional American violinists or from around the world? Or
so they were around the world, from around the world. They were, except two of them, they were all professionals. Some of them were like very, very top players because four of them were contestants at the Indianapolis violin competition. And two of them were actually laureates from this competition. There were two members of the jury, so high caliber violinists as well.
So what do you feel like are the broader conclusions beyond whether or not people can distinguish violins?
So the broader conclusion is out of the 21, 13 players chose a modern one as the one to take home. So obviously, because it's a small sample size, we can't draw any general conclusions to like for a larger population of violinists. But clearly, we can't show any clear preference for Stradivari violins. At least the preference that we would have expected from the reputation of this violin. So we can't demonstrate a clear preference for modern violins. That would be, you know, overstating our results. But we can definitely say that there is not a clear preference for old violins. And that's already challenging conventional wisdom, because I suppose many people would have guessed that the old instruments would have arrived first, you know, for most players.
What does this tell you about kind of the idea of maybe hype or reputation in general, not just with violins, but in terms of other things that are maybe highly valued? I'm thinking of maybe wine or certain types of food or anything,
the same
really.
For everything, I would say. I mean, yeah. The same when you look at a painting, if you're told it's a Picasso, I'm sure you look at it differently than if you don't even know who drawn it. So that's, I mean, I think that in terms of aesthetics and there is a lot of social pressure, and you can convince yourself that, you know, it sounds better because it's this or that, or it tastes better because it's this or that. But the thing as well is, like, if you know it's a Stradivarius, you know that it's an instrument which crossed, you know, centuries, which went through wars and have been played by famous players, and that may really increase your pleasure of playing it, because it's something special, you know, after 300 years to have such a beautiful instrument in your hands. And so if that increases your pleasures and you feel more confident, and you are probably more likely to play it well and to find it nice. So that's just like how psychology works. So
yeah, in a way, I wonder if it's maybe kind of the psychological equivalent of like the placebo effect, where
it is, that's for sure. Yeah. So, I mean, and what is, I think, very interesting as well is it's actually, and that's what our results show, it's not really a question of old or new. It's more a question of this violin or that violin, regardless if it's new or old.
Claudia Freitz, I really appreciate your time and best of luck with your future research.
Thank you very much.
Claudia Freitz is a researcher at the University of Paris. That's all for this week on Spectrum. Want to learn more about something you heard on the show? Send us a message on Twitter at @DW_SciTech. In between episodes, you can always find daily news updates at dw.de/science. From Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn, Germany, I'm Saru Svarivar, and thanks for listening.